came out of the check as it was issued. So from that standpoint, we're not raiding the permanent fund. We're taking a modest amount out of the check.
Legislation that would tax the permanent fund dividend. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, April 5th. Good evening. I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, how public testimony does and does not influence lawmakers.
I'm not saying that public input is not important, but it usually doesn't make a lot of difference if the majority have already decided upon something.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Commercial, sport, subsistence, personal use. Some hear these labels and think conflict. The Salmon Project sees connections. Join 10,000 Alaskans whose lives are connected by Alaska's salmon. Visit salmonlife.org to experience the stories. And find the Salmon Project on Facebook to join the community. Salmon Life, Salmon Love. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
Four nominees to replace an outgoing state Supreme Court justice have been submitted to Governor Bill Walker for review. Walker now has about 6 weeks to name a replacement to the bench. The nominees are attorneys Susan Carney, Andrew Guidi, Jana Lendemuth, and Philip Pallenberg, all of whom have practiced law in Alaska for decades. The four were selected by the Alaska Judicial Council, a body made up of three attorneys, three non-attorneys, and the state Supreme Court's Chief Justice, a position currently held by Craig Stowers. The departing justice is Dana Fabe, currently the only woman on the state's highest court. If her vacancy is filled by a man, Alaska will join just two other states, Idaho and Iowa, in having no women on the state's Supreme Court. Nationwide, women hold just 31% of state court judgeships, according to data from the National Association of Women Judges. Representative Kurt Olson, a Soldotna Republican, developed a plan to tax permanent fund dividends back in February, but he didn't introduce it at the time because he wanted to see how the debate over plans from Governor Bill Walker and others unfolded. But with less than 2 weeks left in the session, Olson decided it was time for House Bill 376. It would apply a 35% tax to dividends.
Would have taken pressure off some of the other things had it been out there in February, which is about when we were done with the design and the modeling of it. But it would have been, it would not been used for what I thought that it should be used for, which is something to buy us some time without being a permanent fixture.
Olson says the tax would have raised $470 million last year, and he estimates it would bring in a similar amount this year. It would sunset after 4 years. Olson says this will allow the state enough time to find a long-term solution to the state's budget problems. He says legislative leaders are interested.
We haven't really looked for comments, but the comments that have been made so far were interested. And that's, I mean, because it does have a certain, you know, simplicity to it, and it's finite. I mean, you know what it's going to be limited to.
But members of the Democratic minority are giving Olson's bill a cool response. Fairbanks Representative Adam Wohl says the state should look for a long-term budget solution this year.
It's another kick the can bill. I mean, it's a quick grab of money out of the permanent fund that doesn't really have any long-term sustainability. It's a short-term fix, and I think it's the wrong way to go.
Olson says it's important to note that his bill wouldn't draw directly from the permanent fund, but from dividend checks. These checks would remain higher than under proposals by other legislators and by the governor.
It did not come out of the earnings reserve, and it did not come out of the CBR. It came out of the check as it was issued. So from that standpoint, we're not raiding the permanent fund. We're taking a modest amount out of the check.
The House Labor and Commerce Committee, which Olson chairs, introduced the bill on Monday. It was referred to the House Finance Committee. Since January, thousands of Alaskans have called in to speak before the Alaska legislature. Their testimony is facilitated by 23 legislative information offices around the state, then channeled into the legislative process. KDLG's Hannah Colton took a hard look at public comments to see where they go, what happens to them, and most importantly, whether or not they have any real effect on the process.
Back in the 1970s, the Alaska legislature took a look at its constituents, scattered across hundreds of miles on islands and off the road system, and decided they needed a better way to hear from them all. The system that resulted, a vast network of teleconferencing that gears up each session, is still the only one of its kind in the United States. That's according to Sue Cotter, the statewide manager of the Information and Teleconference System for the Legislative Affairs Agency. And Cotter says, we're talking about a massive amount of material being funneled through this system.
So far this session, we've conducted 1,105 teleconferences so far. We've had 8,361 individual callers.
But does all that public testimony really matter? Well, sometimes. Remember House Bill 77? It was a water rights bill introduced by former Governor Sean Parnell in 2013 as a way to streamline the process for issuing water and land use permits. HB 77 flew under the radar at first, but when it was brought up again in 2014, it triggered a massive backlash.
This bill is aimed at passing the public and getting the pebble mine their permit.
House Bill 77, see the trash can down by your feet? That's where it belongs.
You are silencing my right to protect our culture, our primary food sources, and our renewable natural resources.
But we use the water to gain access in the harvest of the game. The water is our dinner table.
That was Diane Folsom and Billy Maines of Dillingham, Dolores Larson of Koliganek, and Dennis Andrew of Neustuyahawk. They were among dozens of people who called in during more than 6 hours of public testimony at hearings in mid-March of 2014. And soon, their loud efforts paid off. The bill withered away in Senate Resources Committee, in large part, says Representative Andy Josephson, because of grassroots organizing in the interim between the two sessions.
The folks would gather together, talk to their legislators, and got enormously organized, incredibly organized, so that when they came back, I recall the bill was before State Senator Giesel, and even though she is very serious about resource development, she killed the bill.
Of course, House Bill 77 was a rare accomplishment. For every outcome like House Bill 77, there are probably a dozen that fly in the face of public outcry. Some experts say that's just politics.
I'm not saying that public input is not important, but it usually doesn't make a lot of difference if the majority have already decided upon something.
That's Clive Thomas, a former University of Alaska Southeast political science professor. 3 decades of studying the Alaska legislature and politics has made him somewhat cynical, or realistic, however you may see it.
You can go to a hearing on an issue that, say, for example, that a majority member wants. It could be the chair of the committee, it could be a majority member. You could get 50 people in there talk against the bill and one talk in favor of it, and they'll pass it out because it's already been predetermined.
Given that assessment, it could be hard as a member of the public to see why testifying would be worth your time and energy. For Dan Dunaway, who's a regular at the Dillingham LIO, it's just more painful to stay quiet, even if he knows his voice may not change anything.
It might not, but then they have to do it and look me in the eye and ignore me versus if I don't say a word, that I don't want them to get out of jail free card.
Though statistics on previous year's testimony aren't readily available, there's a consensus among staff at LIO headquarters in Juneau. They say more people are testifying this session than they've seen in decades. In Dillingham, I'm Hannah Colton.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Congressman Don Young talks to Capital City Republicans about the Sturgeon case and public education.
I will tell you, I don't think I could teach today because I can thump somebody. I used to be a good thumper.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. And by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline and its operations today and into the future.
Congressman Don Young yesterday called on Juneau Republicans to support legislative funding for John Sturgeon's legal fight over operating a hovercraft in a national preserve. Young also says that while he is running for re-election, when the time comes for a successor, Alaskans should choose a young person. The congressman told the Capital City Republicans that it takes decades to build up seniority and effectiveness. Young is 83 years old.
And that's something I want you to keep in mind. If you replace me someday, please get a younger person. Not that I have anything against mature citizens, by the way. I want you to know that. I just, because you have to have someone that serves in the House for more than 25 years. And that's a big dedication.
Young says Congress is less effective than it once was. He says that's because committee chairs have lost power.
And I was chairman of transportation. I ran the Congress. I'm not bragging now, but I had 75 votes. I had Democrat votes, and I had Republican votes. They were loyal to the committee. And if the chairman and if the speaker got frisky and said, you can't do this, you can't do that, I said, you watch me.
Young used colorful language during his speech. He's a former teacher, and he endorsed corporal punishment and criticized laws that prevent 15-year-olds from working.
A lot of what we do is incorrectly as far as education goes. It's requirements of the federal government to get the federal dollar. We have to. We're hooked on this sugar tit. It's really what it is, and we're not educating our students. I will tell you, I don't think I could teach today, because I can't thump somebody. I used to be a good thumper.
Young encouraged the audience to support state funding to back Sturgeon's lawsuit. The U.S. Supreme Court recently handed Sturgeon a partial victory and sent his case back to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. Young predicted that the federal appeals court won't change its opinion and the case will return to the Supreme Court. Young was scheduled to speak today at the Tlingit and Haida Central Council Native Issues Forum in Juneau. Upriver travel on the Kuskokwim has just gotten harder. Ice crews have removed road markers between Tuluksac and Kalskag and are advising no more truck traffic between these points. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur reports that means people upriver will be staying in place or shelling out money for airfare until breakup.
Bethel Search and Rescue member Mark Leary says the combined effects of dark sand warming the top of the ice and increased current flowing beneath the ice is creating an unstable surface for trucks on the Kuskokwim. Leary says the amped current comes from last week's snow suddenly falling and then quickly melting. He says the sand comes from an overall lack of snow through the winter, leaving the ground exposed to wind and creating sand drifts on the ice.
We had some of those days where that north wind was howling, you know, and it was just blowing sand like crazy. Sometimes it looked like smoke over the river. So much sand.
Leary measures ice thickness for the National Weather Service. His last measurements in mid-March showed ice reaching 33 inches in Aniak and 36 inches in Napaimute, lengths he calls below average for this time of year.
I don't know if there's such a thing anymore as a normal year, but what we used to see is, you know, ice would be in the 40s or more.
Leary says many open holes never froze this winter, another anomaly for the Kuskokwim. He says no new holes are forming, but the ice is dropping off at the edges and side sloughs are opening. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
The Alaska Board of Game has approved a National Park Service proposal aimed at reducing the number of park wolves killed outside Denali's northern border. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, it's the latest move in a long-running debate over how to manage park wolves that roam onto state land.
The Game Board action will close the wolf hunting season along Denali National Park's northern boundary 6 weeks earlier in the spring, on April 15th instead of May 31st, beginning next year. Denali National Park Science and Resources team leader Dave Schierichauer says the change will eliminate overlap of state wolf hunting and bear baiting seasons on a strip of state land near the Stampede Road, where park wolves roam across the park boundary.
Our concern was that wolves were being taken in association with bear bait, And that happened last spring with two of our wolves, including a breeding female, being taken in association with a bait station near the park boundary on state land.
The game board considered the wolf hunting season change out of cycle at its recently concluded Fairbanks meeting. Game board chairman Ted Spraker noted heavy public testimony in favor of eliminating the overlapping wolf and bear hunts.
I think it goes a long ways to show that this board listens to individuals that have these concerns, and I'm not willing to, in a sense, jeopardize the option of hunting brown bear over a bait across the state in a place where one or two wolves may be taken.
The Denali National Park wolf population was estimated at 62 animals last fall, near a 30-year low. Park biologists consider wolf harvests to be just one factor in the predator's decline. And given low April-May harvest numbers, Shirakauer describes the game board action as a small step toward rebuilding park wolf numbers.
I think it'll have maybe a slight impact.
Hunting and trapping of Denali wolves will continue virtually unabated.
Denali wolf protection advocate Rick Steiner and other conservationists have long advocated for reinstatement of a year-round no-wolf-kill buffer zone along the park's northern edge, like one the game board scrapped back in 2010. Shirakauer says the Park Service supports a buffer and expects numerous proposals to reestablish one next year when the game board is scheduled to consider Denali region issues. Its chances seem slim based on comments from board members like Teresa Sager-Albaugh of Tok, who questioned shortening the spring wolf season at the Park Service's request.
This is like the camel's nose under the tent as far as I'm concerned. It's a step to what equates to ceding state wildlife management to federal management interests.
Sager-Albaugh voted against the change. Steiner describes the game board as stacked with hunters and isn't holding out much hope for it to create a new buffer zone.
The Board of Game will never solve the Denali wolf issue. It needs to be solved with a conservation easement deeded by the state of Alaska to the Park Service in exchange for a like-valued federal asset deeded to the state.
Steiner and other conservationists proposed the land swap idea to create permanent protection for park wolves 3 years ago. It drew interest from Governor Walker and Park Service officials last year, but no action's been taken. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on Condor.com. Condor, born to fly. At Alaska Pacific University, you will be inspired by the beauty of Alaska, motivated by devoted faculty, and surrounded by independent-minded, creative students pursuing their higher education goals. There's no time like the present to find out what they are all about. It's time to experience APU. Hashtag, this is our classroom. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
Anchorage voters are heading to the polls today for municipal elections. Generally, these local contests, especially in years without a mayoral race, see low voter turnout, but arguably have some of the biggest impacts on residents. To talk about what's on the ballot, I'm joined by Alaska Public Media reporter Zachariah Hughes. Hi, Zach.
Hi, Lori.
So what are voters deciding on today, and what do you have your eye on?
Well, voters in Anchorage are deciding on three things. There's a raft of ballot propositions, nine of them altogether. There's also five assembly seats that are up for grabs, and that's a big number because the assembly itself is only 11 people. And then there are two school board seats that are also up for grabs. So between the three of those, you can really think of it as three separate kind of sets of issues. And I'm going to be watching a lot of the ballot measures quite closely. A lot of them are for bonding propositions, some of which feel sort of routine. About $36 million for repairs to roads, resurfacing, drainage, stuff like that. You know, just what an area-wide or service area bond really should go for. And a really big school board bond.
Zach, what about the assembly races? What do you think is important in that mix?
Well, the assembly races are interesting because there's the potential for the balance of power on the assembly to shift. The assembly is not a partisan race. You know, there's no Democrats or Republican affiliations that are part of it. But for people that watch city politics, there's definitely a sort of balance and a contest between liberal and conservative approaches or ideologies that are brought to bear on issues like budgeting or some social issues like the Equal Rights Amendment that this current mayor's administration signed off on. And with 5 of the 11 seats up for, we could see a major change on the assembly.
You have lived in rural Alaska outside of Anchorage. Do you think this is the kind of election that has any bearing on the lives of people across the state, whether that's in the valley or Deering, Yakutat? What do you think?
Yes and no. I mean, I'd say this is much more important than tennis courts were a couple of years ago for rural voters. But I think sometimes in Anchorage, we can get pretty myopic with things that feel really important within the bounds of the municipality and not much without. But what I will say is that because there's so many people here, because so many people pass through here, because Anchorage has such a big footprint on the state's finances, what happens here resonates outward. And some of that is just, you know, if zoning requirements change and there's more hotels in Midtown, like we've seen, you know, that ends up having an impact on people's visits, whether it's for medical or conferences, stuff like that. There's other things like the assembly where you might not see that that's the body that's greenlighting a capital project request to the state, which ends up, you know, potentially financing the port, which influences all of the state. So there's a lot of invisible strings that connect back to a lot of the Anchorage elections, financially especially. And even if it might not feel relevant or particularly immediate to somebody in Nome or Kotzebue or, you know, Ketchikan, what's happening here, I would say that, you know, the ripples are going outward.
All right, Zach, thanks. We'll look for results tomorrow. A Southeast lawmaker wants communities to be able to contribute directly to the Alaska Marine Highway System. Representative Sam Keto III, a Juneau Democrat, authored House Bill 292. It had its first hearing last week in the House Transportation Committee. He called it a simple one-line bill that could help the financially strapped ferry system.
The intent is not that it go back into a specific community, but that money go into a general pot to be used for the betterment of the marine highway system in some way.
That could be increased marketing or another effort. Committee member Shelley Hughes, a Palmer Republican, asked whether the bill would exclude communities that don't contribute. Keto says it wouldn't, and he says his legislation isn't just about money.
I see it more as a tool to bring the communities more to the table with the Department of Transportation, get them talking, maybe even formally over some kind of a memorandum of understanding or memorandum of agreement that you become engaged as a shareholder in the marine highway system.
The bill remains in the House Transportation Committee and is not expected to progress this session. Sitka has a sister city in Nemuro, Japan. Like Sitka, Nemuro is an ocean-facing fishing port, but larger, about 30,000 people to Sitka's 10,000. And on Monday, Nemuro citizens visited Sitka's City Hall to commemorate their decades-long relationship. KCW's Emily Kwong was there.
If you were to trace your finger on a map starting in Sitka and moving downward across the Pacific Ocean, you could draw a direct line to our sister city, Nemuro. And the connection is embodied in one man, Atso Tsunoda.
I kind of coordinating between the city of Sitka and Nemuro relationship since I moved to Sitka in 1978.
Tsunoda is a neatly dressed man and the most cheerful translator I've ever met, gracefully bridging communication between city staff and the Japanese delegation.
Mr. Honda, Mrs. Honda.
The group included Nemuro Assembly member Toshiharu Honda, who last visited Sitka in 1999 with the all-Japanese East Point Jazz Orchestra for Alaska Day.
That's he dreams to repeatedly visit again, yeah. And this is actually, dreams come true.
Mr. Honda was joined by his wife, Kimiko, and 4 friends. The occasion, commemorating 40 years as Sitka's sister city.
1975, both city, titled the sister city relationship. And it has passed.
At a press conference Monday morning, City Administrator Mark Gorman and Mayor Mim McConnell opened piles of gifts, guidebooks and taiko drumming sticks wrapped in pink crepe paper. One of of the Nemuro citizens, Konihiro Kobayashi, presented a calendar of paintings he made himself.
He's an artist.
Artist, yes.
Yeah. He's got an Henri Matisse look to him.
In return, Gorman presented a print of a raven and an eagle, the two moieties of the Tlingit tribe.
This is the land of the Tlingit people, and so we share this image with our sister city.
The two groups then split bottles of Sikkim-made root beer and chatted while their translator, Tsunoda, took a break. Turns out, the two cities have been partnered in business since the 1970s, when a man named Masao Mazuzawa, then board director of the Nemuro Fishermen's Association, visited Sitka.
Nemuro is a very strong seafood business, and Sitka is also very strong.
The two cities became officially linked in 1975 through the timber industry as well. Tsunoda is really organized, and he produced a neatly printed timeline detailing the diplomatic relationship between the two cities across the decades. The Baranoff Bluegrass Band performed for Nemuro audiences in 1980. High school students were pen pals in 1993. But after that big Alaska Day visit in 1999, the Nemuro-Sitka relationship kind of waned. Tsunoda said it's probably because of changes in the global economy.
Japan's kind of the economy is kind of flat. Those fish industries tied up a relationship to Sitka, but as you know, the Sitka-san seafood or other industry, they catch the herring, I believe most of the herring to Japan. So those businesses still, you know, continuing.
Tsunoda makes an effort to come to Sitka every April for herring spawn. He was an employee of the pulp mill from 1978 until its closure. And he says this visit, initiated by that assembly member, Mr. Honda, is an attempt to revive diplomatic relationships between citizens, all business aside.
Business is kind of slowed down, but he wants to do to tie up more citizens' relationship, especially young people.
Which is why the group will not be returning to Nemuro without making a stop at Kikushahin Elementary School to meet with Sitka's youngest citizens. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Emily Kwong.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Andrew Kitchenman and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Hannah Colton in Dillingham, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Emily Kwong in Sitka. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
The weeks are counting down until the first salmon return home to Alaska rivers and streams. Alaska's people live lives that are deeply connected to salmon. Alaska's economy and families are fueled by these relationships. Learn more about Alaska's salmon at salmonlife.org. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project. Support for Alaska Public Media's Energy News Desk comes from Bettesworth North, Architects and Planners, and the Atwood Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.